Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
We've got good news. The world is open again, and people like you, people of faith, are traveling to Catholic sites around the world. Want to travel with exceptional Catholic leaders this fall, next year, or in the future? Are you looking to see specific sites, celebrate traditional Latin Mass, or travel to destinations without vaccine requirements? We are here to help you deepen your faith on pilgrimage. Give us a call at 1-800-842-4842 or visit us online at selectinternationaltours.com. Select International Tours is your pilgrimage company, and we have the perfect Catholic trip for you.
Are you looking to serve God and society? Consider putting your gifts to work as a lawyer. Ave Maria School of Law has been educating faith-filled lawyers for over 20 years. Ave Maria School of Law is committed to training lawyers to use law appropriately around the moral issues of our time. Visit avemarialaw.edu to learn more about integrating your faith with a law degree.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live on this ninth day of Christmas. I think it's the ninth day of Christmas. I'm not so good with numbers, but whatever day of Christmas it is still the Christmas season. And so Merry Christmas to you and Happy New Year to you. We continue this hour with our don't know what you would say, remembrance, tribute, assessment, maybe all of those of the life and the ministry of Pope Benedict XVI. We've been so blessed with our guests, and we are blessed again this segment with a wonderful guest to talk about the life and ministry of Benedict XVI. He's the Archbishop of Portland, Oregon. Bishop Alexander Sample, like many, many fine priests. He's a metallurgist. He's a metallurgical engineer, but ordained a priest in 1990. He was appointed the Bishop of Marquette, Michigan in 2005 by Pope Benedict XVI, and he was appointed the 11th Archbishop of Portland in Oregon in 2013. Archbishop Sample, thank you very much for being here with us.
Well, I'm so honored and pleased to be here to pay tribute to this incredible and holy Pope for the Church.
One of the things that you are known for, and I think that maybe the font of this, partially the font of this, is the life and work of Benedict XVI, is the holiness of the liturgy, the power of the liturgy when properly celebrated. Was he meaningful to you as a liturgical reformer?
My entire liturgical outlook is formed by Pope Benedict XVI. I honestly believe that his writings and his practice of the sacred liturgy will be one of his greatest legacies that will be recognized in time. It began influencing me very, very early on in my life. In fact, this is my original copy of the Feast of Faith, which Pope Benedict, the then Joseph Ratzinger, wrote in 1981. I began reading this just as I was beginning my theological studies, and so we associate him with the Spirit of the Liturgy, which is his monumental work and is really his signature work on the sacred liturgy. But it really began earlier than that with the Feast of Faith. So very early on at the beginning of my seminary formation, I began to be formed by the mind and the heart and the spirituality of Pope Benedict XVI around the sacred liturgy. And I think it will be one of his greatest legacies.
Can you help us get past that? I mean, one of the things that you got to do when you talk about Pope Benedict, you get past a lot of caricatures of him. And one of those would be this idea that, well, there's the old liturgy, and he's just a guy who was attached to the old liturgy and did everything he can to go backwards liturgically.
No, this is completely a misrepresentation of the mind of Pope Benedict XVI. It really is. Even though he is responsible for introducing a greater ability to celebrate the traditional Mass in the Church, that was not his intent. His intent was clearly, and he said it many, many times, and he said it to me personally, in personal conversation, that his intent was to bring about a reconciliation in the heart of the Church, of the Church with her past. This whole idea of seeing both the liturgical and the theological development of after the Council with this hermeneutic of continuity with the past, that there should be and cannot be a rupture. The church did not literally hit a reset button at the Second Vatican Council. And so his intent liturgically was to reconcile the church with her past, because he clearly had seen that there had been a rupture in the reform. He often would speak of the need for a reform of the reform. And that was his real intent, was to certainly honor the Second Vatican Council and Sacrosanctum Concilium and the renewal of the sacred liturgy. He was one of the scholars who sought to bring about this liturgical movement inspired by Romano Guardini. But he wanted it to be in continuity with the past. And so he felt that we needed to recover some of what had been lost in the liturgical reform and recover the sacredness of the liturgy, the beauty of the liturgy. And that was his intent, not to be just a throwback to the past, but to look to the future, but deeply rooted and connected with the tradition, especially the liturgical tradition.
Excellency, in his interview with the Italian journalist that became what Ignatius Press published as the Ratzinger Report, he makes the point that in Sacrosanctum Concilium, there is that phrase in the Latin, I think it's something like participio actuosa or something like that, active participation. Mm-hmm. And he said, this is one of the most misunderstood passages of the document. And he goes on to say that it became widely interpreted as a sort of a need that was felt for a large number of people sort of, you know, to be doing something. And so now we have lots of laity who are looking for work in the sanctuary, and then we have people in the nave, and they're moving their arms up and down and this sort of thing. And he said this is missing it entirely.
Absolutely. The whole idea, and remember, he was a peritus, an expert, a theological expert at the council. He is deeply rooted in the council and the meaning of the council. And that whole phrase, that whole idea of full, conscious, active participation of the faithful in the sacred liturgy was meant primarily to refer to the mind and the heart being fully engaged in the liturgical action, not in activity. In other words, those engaged in the sacred liturgy don't need to always be saying something or doing something. It's about entering into the sacred mystery, to be truly, consciously, actively engaged in the action that is happening in the liturgy, the action of Christ in the liturgy. And, you know, there was a recognition that there had been a disconnect, you know, perhaps before the council, where people were not really fully engaged in the liturgical action and plugged in, as we say, and oftentimes doing other prayers and devotions, perhaps. And this was the intent of the council, was to re-engage the congregation, the assembly gathered in prayer, with the action at the altar, but primarily mind and heart. That's what full, active, conscious participation meant in the mind of the council fathers.
And in fact, it may be that, Cy, a little more silence, in fact, would facilitate that active participation.
Absolutely. In fact, Pope Benedict, in the spirit of the liturgy, even goes so far as to say that perhaps from time to time, even parts of the Eucharistic prayer, the canon of the Mass, could be said silently, as it was in the traditional liturgy, to allow people to prayerfully enter in. I deliberately, even when I and he says this in here as well, even when there's no music at the time of the offertory prayers, I say those prayers silently, as he even recommends, because it gives people a chance to pray, enter in spiritually into the action of what's happening, because sometimes we can get too distracted by the words and the actions and always needing to do or say something.
Well, yeah, and in fact, you had mentioned that he's heavily, heavily influenced by Romano Guardini. And in Guardini's excellent book on, I think it's called The Art of Prayer, he says, unless you're collected, unless you have collectedness, this is the word that Guardini uses, you can't pray. You have to be collected first. And then silence facilitates that.
Bishop, I do want to take advantage a little bit of the fact that we have you here to ask you about maybe some of your private conversations with Pope Benedict on liturgy. Because I know go ahead, please.
Yeah, you know, I was always a great admirer of his work on the liturgy, and I told him so. And there were many times when maybe just as a brief conversation after a general audience, I would always say to him, "Thank you again, Holy Father, for your work on the sacred liturgy." And he got to know me after a while. And I remember one time I said to him, "I want to thank you so much for the incredible effort and work that you're putting into the sacred liturgy." And he said to me just very simply, in that wonderful German accent in English, he says, "Well, if we don't have the liturgy, what do we have?"
Right. Yeah.
And then during our Limina visit in 2012, I spoke to him during our audience with the Holy Father about the sacred liturgy. And he launched into a lengthy catechesis on the sacred liturgy, and even on Summorum Pontificum and why he issued Summorum Pontificum and this whole idea of reconciling the church with her past. And then in the final conversation I had with him, he granted me a private audience, God bless him, about a year after he had resigned from the papacy. And he gave me 15 minutes to have conversation with him. And I asked him, "What is your advice to a bishop in the church today to continue your work in the sacred liturgy?" And he said two things. Number one, teach, 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 and give good example. Give good example of how the liturgy should be celebrated with beauty, with reverence, with dignity. And that's what he did in his own witness. He taught, but he also showed us how the sacred liturgy can and should be celebrated with that great beauty and dignity and reverence.
What a grace to have 15 minutes with this capital heart and mind.
So you met with him in the monastery where he was living there?
Just outside the monastery. He and Archbishop Ganschwein go for a walk in the Vatican Gardens every evening to pray the rosary before dinner. And it was arranged that I would meet with them as they came in from their rosary walk just before they went into the monastery. So we got to visit for a while. I said to the Holy Father, I said, "Yes, I was going to say you appointed me Archbishop of Portland, and I never got to thank you." So I got the words out. "You appointed me the Archbishop of Portland." He says, "Yeah." He says, "You was one of my last appointments." he obviously remembered the appointment.
So he figured, I've done as good as I can do now. I might as well just resign.
<That's right.
laughs> we just maybe have you for a few more seconds, Archbishop. Archbishop Alexander Sample of the Archdiocese of Portland, our guest. Just as a person, what was it like to be in the presence of Pope Benedict XVI?
I was always so deeply struck simply by his humility, his gentleness, you know, this caricature, again, that you've been talking about it on this program, this caricature of him, of this hardliner, this mean kind of figure, this Rottweiler figure. He was the gentlest, kindest person you'd ever want to meet. And you were struck by the holiness that was about him. You know, I wear the pectoral cross every day that he gave us in that 2012 Ad Limina visit. And I will wear this pectoral cross, I think, for the rest of my life, and as a remembrance of this kind and gentle and holy, holy Pope for the Church.
Archbishop Sample, thank you so much for taking the time with us and sharing your recollections of Pope Benedict XVI.
Well, thank you for doing this program.
And we have to take this break, so we'll take this break, and when we come back, we'll do our very best. We'll have Archbishop Cordiglione with it. We'll have Archbishop Cordiglione, Archbishop of San Francisco here in California, right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious mystic monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All mystic monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase mystic monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
One time somebody said to me, why don't you air these people? And I said, no, because I don't think they're Catholic. He says, by what right do you have to say that? I said, I own the network.
Mother Angelica Live Classics. Every morning, 2 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live on this ninth day of Christmas. We are celebrating the life and reflecting on the many contributions of Joseph Ratzinger, later Pope Benedict XVI, as you know, of course, recently deceased. And among those whose lives have been profoundly affected by the life and ministry of Joseph Ratzinger, our next guest, and all of our guests today, this is the highest ranking churchman we will have on with us. And I say highest ranking because that means he was ordained for the Diocese of San Diego, and it's pretty hard to get higher than that. But he also served 7 years in the Supreme Tribunal of the Apostolic Signatura, which is the Church's highest canonical court. In 2002, Pope John Paul II appointed then Monsignor Corleone as auxiliary bishop here in the Diocese of San Diego. He went on to be the bishop, the fourth bishop of Oakland, California, and in 2012, he was appointed Archbishop of San Francisco. Archbishop Salvatore Corleone, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Happy to be with you.
When you were in Rome there all those years with the Apostolic Signatura, did you have an opportunity to have personal encounters with Joseph Ratzinger?
Not during those years too much. No, I would more like see him in passing, but I didn't have any kind of official encounters with him at that time. I had met him before as a priest, and then, of course, later on as a bishop a couple of times.
And was it he that appointed you the bishop in Oakland?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it was Pope Benedict appointed me to Oakland and then appointed me to San Francisco after that.
And we've had so many folks on talking about his many contributions. Maybe I could just start by asking you about what his time as bishop, as cardinal, as pope meant for the life of the church. What is your sense of what all of that meant?
It's hard to know where to start with that. He is a towering figure of a theologian with an amazing breadth and depth of knowledge and insight into our Catholic faith tradition, but also not just to, like, his understanding of it, but his ability to communicate it. He had an amazing ability to summarize volumes of wisdom and teaching in, like, small pithy phrases. And so many of his writings are writings that are accessible to just about anyone. So it's a brilliant theologian, but then knows how to communicate it. He has a great legacy in terms of the liturgy and all of his writings on the liturgy and the way he modeled that with his own life and him understanding that that's at the heart of who we are as Catholic. That informs everything we believe as Catholics and how we live. So he understood the centrality of that. We can think of his Wednesday audiences. He gave that series of talks on the Fathers of the Church, of course, being a specialist in St. Augustine. He understood the Fathers also as a force for Christian unity. It's the common roots with especially with the East. There are so many things to say about the legacy that he's leaving the Church for us.
Can I ask you about that last one, Excellency? Because I know from recent conversations that you and I had that you have a good friendship with the Orthodox up there in San Francisco. And I wonder, do you find that is informed by the work of Benedict, that friendship?
It's certainly helpful. You know, of course, Pope Paul VI started that with the mutual lifting of the excommunication. But I think Pope Benedict's vision of, you know, the early fathers has been a driving force for our relationships with the Greek Orthodox in San Francisco.
Good.
The other thing about San Francisco, and I don't think this is probably news to you, but it's a profoundly secularized city. And one of the things that certainly as Pope and also as Cardinal that Benedict was concerned about was the loss of God. It's the quite striking and historically speaking, sudden loss of God in many places. He didn't want to react to that just by lecturing the world, however, that he seemed to want to invite people back to the person of Jesus Christ. That seemed to be the center of what he was about. Does that inform your work there in San Francisco?
Certainly. Pope Francis emphasizes a lot about this culture of encounter, but so did Benedict. You know, he emphasized that our faith is not a series of doctrinal propositions, but it's an encounter with the person. So he emphasized that living encounter with the person of Jesus Christ. Of course, that encounter is mediated through the human encounter, which Pope Francis emphasizes. And I think that's how, if we talk about evangelization, that's how it has to, there's no getting around the personal encounter if we're going to touch hearts with the gospel message of Jesus Christ. So that certainly does inform a lot of what I do in my ministry as the Archbishop of San Francisco.
His concern, it's been speculated, why did he take the name Benedict? And certainly the prior Benedict, Benedict the 15th, I'm sure had some influence on him. But I think that's also the sense that he wanted to reach all the way back to Benedict of Nursia, I think, in the original evangelization of Europe, because he wanted to emphasize that, I mean, Europe has really led the world in losing the Christian faith, and that he wanted to not give up on the modern world, the modern secular world, but to somehow embrace that world and kind of do a critique from within it, one that wasn't a critique of, oh, we're over here critiquing you, but from within to say, I'm a modern person as well, but Christ belongs to me and can belong to you.
He certainly was consistently calling Europe to its Christian roots, to recover its Christian heritage, which built up the great civilization that it did. And I agree with you about why he picked the name Benedict. I think it was mostly influenced by Benedict of Nursia. If we think about what was happening in the church and in the world at the time, it was at the end of the Roman Empire. Everything, civilization was collapsing. There was a lot of corruption in the church. And Benedict was very disillusioned with what he saw in Rome. So really the process of rebuilding civilization and then building it in a Christian way in Europe, it began with Benedict, with forming the monasteries. And it's the monasteries, really, that rebuilt civilization and built up this Christian civilization, a civilization with God at the center, as you were saying earlier, and with imbued by the Jesus Christ. So I think he probably saw our world in a similar situation with the loss of God and needing to rebuild. And so I would imagine that, yes, but Benedict the 15th also, given what happened in the world after the aftermath of World War I, there was also, we see a significant step in the direction of loss of God then as well.
Benedict the 16th has been a particular inspiration to you, Your Excellency, with respect to sacred music, right? And you've founded this institute named for him. Correct me if I'm wrong, for the promotion of sacred music. Develop that for us.
Yes, for sacred music and sacred liturgy. So I named it after Pope Benedict because he's made such a great contribution to the church in this area of beauty and liturgy, and especially with sacred music. And so I wanted to do something practical to recover this beautiful patrimony we have of the sacred art in music and reverence in liturgy. But I think music is really at the heart of it because it just animates so much of our worship. And there's so many treasures we have in that area. And Benedict was calling us to that. And he helped us to, I think, acquire a much deeper understanding and theological understanding of the liturgy, not just something mechanical, but but its roots, its biblical roots, and the theological significance of it. So he's been such a great inspiration to me, and I know many others in that area. And I think this will be one of his major legacies, is his call for us to recover the sacredness of our liturgical and artistic tradition.
And of course, he was a musician himself.
I believe so. He was a pianist, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
If someone wanted to know more, Excellency, about your work with respect to sacred music, where would they look?
Yes, thank you. They could go to the website, benedictinstitute.org, to find out the latest. We're commissioning new masses. The first one, it became quite well known now, the Mass of the Americas, mm-hmm. even in the secular world of classical music. It was for 2 weeks, mid last year, it was number one on the Billboard charts.
Was it really? Well, congratulations on that. That's Frank.
Frank LaRocca is a composer.
Frank LaRocca, yeah. A wonderful, wonderful composer.
So the idea is, so again, this is inspired by Pope Benedict. We're commissioning new masses of sacred music that are, they're contemporary in the sense of they reflecting contemporary themes, but they're in the tradition of sacred polyphony, so they have a certain timelessness to it. I often compare it, it's being done musically, what the Franciscan missionaries did here in California, visually with the mission church architecture. You know, when they were trying to evangelize the indigenous population here, they didn't just celebrate mass in camps and leave it at that. They built churches. Mm-hmm. They built traditional Catholic church, but it also reflects the culture that's here. They had to use the materials, obviously, the adobe bricks for building, but kind of the colors and the whole style of art. It was a real enculturation of the gospel. And so it's an architecture of a certain time and place, but it also has a timeless beauty to it because it's within continuity of the tradition. So that's what we're doing with the sacred music. So the Mass of the Americas, with the popular devotional song, Starling in Guadalupe, the work with Mass for the Homeless, conveying sense on the streets through sacred music. So these special themes, but they're also in the tradition of the music.
We have to take a quick break. The Archbishop of San Francisco is our guest, and we're reflecting on the life and ministry of Pope Benedict XVI. We'll continue that, and we'll give a little announcement right after this. The recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade was a monumental victory for the pro-life movement. But the fight is far from over. With our new booklet, Why We're Pro-Life, we have produced the perfect tool to prepare you to have peaceful and convincing conversations to shed light on the truth about human life from conception to natural death. Catholic Answers is printing millions of copies of this booklet, and we plan simply to give them away. You can help us in two ways. First, by generously supporting this project. 25 cents prints one book. $2,500 prints 10,000, and so on. Second, by helping us distribute the booklet through your parish, your school, or the pro-life ministry you work with. Catholic Answers is going to blanket the country with Why We're Pro-Life. But only if you step up and help us. Thank you so much. For more information, visit whyweareprolife.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity in The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As Catholic apologetics have gotten stronger, Protestant responses have gotten stronger as well. And now they have their own answers to rebut the standard Catholic proofs. Don't fret, we've got you covered. In his new book, Meeting the Protestant Response, apologist Carlo Broussard gives well-reasoned biblical answers to Protestant comebacks. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Response today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. and Merry Christmas to you, because we are still in the Christmas season here. Archbishop Salvatore Corleone is our guest from San Francisco. He was exiled to San—I mean, no, appointed to San Francisco from San Diego. I only say that because, you know, of my profound love for the Diocese of San Diego. But Archbishop Corleone didn't know this. We just told him at the break, and I probably should have waited to tell him on the air and gotten that reaction on the air. Yeah. But he was chosen by our radio club members and our Society 315 members as the Catholic person of 2022. So we will go back to discussing Pope Benedict, but I didn't want to deny you the opportunity to accept this very high honor, Catholic Person of the Year.
Yeah, I want to assure you, Excellency, this does not come with a cash prize.
Or anything else.
Any size whatsoever. Maybe a decent bottle of Napa Cabernet or something.
Well, thank you so much. It's quite an honor for me. This really does come as a surprise. So I'm grateful to you, grateful to all the listeners for confidence in me. And please...
You're an inspiration.
Well, I'll tell you, it'll be even a higher honor when I tell you this. The year before, the winner was Father Mike Schmitz. So you are up there in the pantheon.
Yeah, now, that's there.
I mean, you've never done Bible in a year, but you've had a lot of other fine accomplishments, Archbishop.
Excellency, all of our guests in the previous hour and in this one have had an opportunity to address the question which is coming up in all the obituaries on the favorable and unfavorable ones, but the undeserved names, the Rat, God's Rottweiler, Benedict's reputation for being sort of a cold German theologian, and all the which don't really accord with the personality of the man at all.
I mentioned earlier about had an opportunity to interact with him earlier when I was a priest. I was in graduate studies, and I was living at the Casa Santa Maria, the residence for American priests, graduate studies there. One of the members of the house invited him to speak to us. So that was the first time I saw him personally and heard him speak. And I was just stunned at how different he was from the reputation and the public perception. It was the complete opposite. A man of graciousness and humility. He listens well. He's just like the diametrically opposed to the public perception. And he's a man of great warmth, too. So it's quite, but he has a brilliant mind, and he understands that there is nuance. Not everything is black and white. Some things there are gray areas, and he understands that, but there's also some things are black and white. And so, again, the sense of clarity, the light he could focus on that, but with an ability, a compassion, an ability to listen and understand was truly remarkable.
This kind of caricaturing of him, though, however, as a kind of dark personality, it does seem that you yourself and many of the leaders of the church are you represent something publicly that is quite threatening to some in this who have more secular agendas, and so this kind of comes with the territory for you guys, and by that I mean Pope Benedict, Pope Francis, yourself. You have to deal with the fact that you're not going to be treated with kindness in every news story. You're going to be caricatured sometime, don't you?
Well, sure. I mean, that's not an uncommon thing to be stereotyped that way, but I think it's most of all happened with Pope Benedict, and he also doesn't have that kind of personality that's real forceful. You know, that can kind of break through filters because he is more and more on the humble side. But yes, that does go with the terrain. And I think to stereotype him that way and cast this as the image of him does serve a certain agenda. And I can't help but think that at least partially is cause for that sort of false stereotype of him.
Yeah, indeed. What did you make of? I mean, you're there in Rome, Pope. You've got these really historic churchmen, really. Between him and John Paul II, it's really an extraordinary moment to think. You know, we've lived in a time of people such as this is really quite extraordinary. What did you make of their partnership?
Oh, I thought they were a good complement to each other. It was just such a great blessing for the church. And for me personally, God gave me this great privilege to have a front seat and all of that. I arrived in Rome for my theology studies in the seminary the day before the installation of Pope John Paul I.
Wow.
So I was there for his death and his funeral. I was in the piazza when John Paul II was elected pope. I was able to meet him and interact with him on a number of occasions. And then, as mentioned here, Ratzinger speak, and then as a bishop, interact with him when he was the pope. So God really gave me a front seat, and I saw the great vision and depth of these men, and especially their understanding of the Second Vatican Council, what it really means and how we have to read it and what it doesn't mean. So I saw them really with great minds and great pastoral outreach, getting the church back on a track of an authentic reading of the Second Vatican Council in light of the continuity of the tradition.
And there were real battles, though, in those years, in the late 1970s, throughout the 1980s. Maybe that's where some of the God's Rottweiler stuff comes from. But they did have to stand firm in the face of enormous pressure.
Oh, yes. Yes, they did. But these were men who were honed at a very dark time in the history of
In their
of
own
Europe.
Nations, yeah.
Yes, with the communism and Nazism, the National Socialism, and the Second World War. That world, it was a world of great suffering, but it produced some very strong leaders, and they were the beneficiaries of that.
Well, do you have anything that Pope Benedict wrote that you say, well, if you really want to know the mind of the man, go to this? Is there a favorite that you've got?
Well, it'd be a toss-up between his trilogy on the Jesus of Nazareth series. I think that demonstrates very well his depth of insight into Scripture and his ability to communicate it in a very accessible way. Of course, a lot of us also look to as kind of the Bible for our liturgical guide as his Spirit of the Liturgy, which, again, so much in-depth into the liturgical traditions and why we do things the way we do, what the theological meaning is. So I would say that those two would be
the trilogy of Jesus of Nazareth and then Spirit of the Liturgy, the great work on liturgy. He wrote Introduction to Christianity. I don't know who he thought he was introducing to Christianity. Like, you have to have a theology degree to understand it. It's hard, but it's like, did you have that sense, Archbishop?
Yes. Yes, I think that was meant more for an advanced theological audience.
Yeah, like you better have gotten an introduction before this.
But it was also earlier on in his career as well, and I think probably over time he developed that ability to communicate it to a wider audience.
You have the Benedict the 16th Institute, and we'll give out that information again, because I do think people should know it. I really hope everyone will listen to the Mass of the Americas and hear the fine work that's being done there, in honor of and inspired by the work of Pope Benedict the 16th himself to renew liturgy in a genuine way that wasn't just let's do what they were doing in the 16th century, but was let's recover the full power and beauty of the liturgy for the modern person. You said you thought that would be his legacy, that's kind of what we'll, in the long run, really appreciate about him.
Oh, it was certainly one of them. Maybe the great, not the only, but the greatest. Because I find this curious irony that in the secular classical music, the great orchestras play the great symphonies of the great composers. They continue to play Beethoven and Mozart and Brahms, and their new compositions as well. So the same thing should apply for sacred classical music. The Renaissance polyphony is beautiful in every age. It doesn't get outdated. But there can also be new compositions to add to their tradition. So that's what we're trying to accomplish with the Benedict XVI Institute. And yes, I thank you for saying that. Everyone should hear the Mass of the Americas to see what can be done, especially those who are familiar with Our Lady of Guadalupe traditions,
yes,
because they'll hear that music and those themes woven all throughout. And so it really is a sort of a Marian unity effort. They can find more information on that at the website, benedictinstitute.org. We also find that we try to teach chant too to children. You mentioned during the break our friend Marianne Carr Wilson that does chant camps.
Right here in San Diego.
Teens, and I tell you, it forms a Catholic soul in those young people, and they're going to be Catholic for life now, and they love it.
Yeah, that we have certainly learned that here, where our president sitting next to me here, Chris Jeck, has encouraged us in the praying of the hours, that the church's liturgy, but the chant that the church that comes out of the heart of the church is formative. It forms the soul, and you're right that those people will be Catholic for life that are formed in this music. So thank you for the Pope Benedict XVI Institute, but also Archbishop Corleone, thank you for taking this time to remember Pope Benedict with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
I think we got, it's a little bit of a step down, but we're going to go to Joe Heschmeyer next. After one of the great churchmen of the American scene today, we'll go to Joe Heschmeyer. But that's what we're going to do. We'll be right back with
He'll
that right after
job.
This on Catholic Answers Live.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
He was a 10th century saint, priest, mystic, and doctor of the church, honored as the first poet of Armenia.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
Gregory of Narek is revered by Armenians as a watchful angel in human form. His masterwork, the Book of Lamentations, was intended to be his last testament, an encyclopedia of prayer for all nations. He was named a Doctor of the Church in 2015.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm so grateful for Archbishop Corleone taking the time. In addition to being the Archbishop of San Francisco, also voted the Catholic of the Year for 2022 by our listeners. So grateful to Archbishop Sample, to Jimmy Akin, who came on earlier, J.D. Flynn, to Bishop Conley. So many personal stories. It's just wonderful. Genuine affection from everybody for Pope Benedict XVI.
Yeah, in particular, Cy, the stories of people, Archbishop Sample's tale of spending 15 minutes with him there after he was no longer Pope there in the Vatican Garden and talking about the liturgy and getting some counsel from him. Very, very moving. All those were great stories.
I didn't know you could ask for 15 minutes with an ex-Pope. If I had known, I'd have asked. I mean, I'm... You never know. He might have
been going to say. I'm
you
not
don't.
Sure.
You don't think he? I don't think I would have got it.
Maybe Joe Heschmeyer.
Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. Joe Heschmeyer, of course, apologist extraordinaire, the proprietor of the Shameless Popery podcast, and just a great person to conclude
one
with. One third of the flannel panel. Joe Heschmeyer, thanks for being here with us.
My pleasure. I'm happy to be here.
So you're a guy who you're an attorney. You go to be a priest. You're in the seminary now, a lay apologist. All of that happened during the time when Joseph Ratzinger or later Pope Benedict was either Pope or Pope Emeritus. This guy must figure in your life in a very large way.
Oh, tremendously. Actually, even before, well, I've got kind of a funny story, because in college, when I was first kind of reconnected to the faith in a real and kind of deep way, one of the major issues I'd struggled with was, well, what does the church have to say to contemporary issues like the rights of the poor in third world countries and these things? And so one of the things I was drawn to was what's called liberation theology. And it was really exciting as a, you know, a young college student. And so I was taking a Latin American history class, and I was doing this essay on liberation theology. And as I'm researching, I submit the first draft of the paper, which is extremely pro-liberation theology. And then two things happen between the first draft and the final draft. The first one is I discovered then Cardinal Ratzinger's Notes on a Theology of Liberation, in which he very charitably, but very systematically dismantles what's wrong with liberation theology and shows its weaknesses and shortcomings. And I thought, oh, no, I'm going to have to change this paper pretty dramatically. And then the second thing that happened is John Paul II died and Benedict became Pope. And I thought, I'm definitely going to have to change this paper.
I have to change this paper and my life.
Yeah.
Well,
exactly. Well, it very much was the case. It was the beginning of a real love of his theology, of his clarity and lucidity. And just like, you know, he said that he was a man who could speak in paragraphs, where even in talking to him, he was so organized in his thinking that if you said, what's your thought about this? He could say, well, there's three parts to that response, and the second part has two parts. And yeah. it was just really that, just the brilliance and the lucidity of thought. And, you know, as anyone who's ever heard me ramble knows, that's not an easy thing to do.
No, it's a striking clarity. I mean, astonishing clarity of expression that can only come from mastery of the thought and the spirit underneath it all. You know, that there's... That kind of ability to express things understandably doesn't come from being a simple person. It comes from being an extremely well-educated person, so much so that you've mastered it and can express it simply and directly.
Well, yeah, I'd say even more than that. It comes from a kind of attentiveness, the kind of attentiveness that makes you a good student, but also the kind of attentiveness that makes you really know the other person. Because there are plenty of people who are very erudite, very well-read, but they can't organize their thinking in that way or express it in a simple way, human to human, because they're missing that other piece. You know, they might have the information, but there's a sort of human connection. And you know, the philosopher Simone Weil talks about this as attention. And I think that's a good way of describing it. A kind of attention to work is study. A kind of attention to the other person is love of neighbor. And a kind of attention to God is prayer. And that there's a kind of underlying theme of attentiveness in the writings of Joseph Ratzinger and Benedict XVI, as well as the interactions people had with him personally, where they just... they were the only person in the room for him. That kind of attentiveness, I think, is a kind of unifying theme to his thought and his work.
I'm going to propose something to you, Joe, and I want to get your take on it. And that is that by the standards of the world, really, he should not be thought of as a doctrinaire conservative, but as a radical. And that he wanted he wanted us to live a radically different life than we are living currently in the modern world. That he saw that human beings, that humanity was ill-served by all of this modern stuff. He wanted us more in touch with nature. He wanted us less consumerist and exploitive. He was a wild-eyed radical. What do you make of my thesis?
Yeah, I mean, etymologically, radical comes from radix, root. Mm-hmm. You know, it's about getting back to the roots of a thing.
Like a radish.
And I think... Yeah, well, radishes are so named from the same root, root word of root. I'd really
root
into
is
that
the root word. Yes.
Why are you derailing?
Yes. Sorry, go ahead, Joe. Give me your take on the radical Joseph
Ratzinger. I take little derailing. If you think about his work in terms of getting deeper into the Church Fathers, you know, he was very much in kind of the spirit of ressourcement, of like going back to what did the early Christians say about this? How did they approach liturgy? What did they think about that? And so very radical in that sense of saying, if we want restoration, it's a restoration from within, a restoration from going back to the roots. But additionally, also going back to the roots in a very human sense. So he was known as the Green Pope. And so there's this sense of like we've gotten too cut off, not just from our Christian roots, but even from our human connection to nature. And those may not seem like related ideas, but there's this sort of modern sense in which we've become so cut off from our own past and from the natural world in which we live that we live in a kind of modern world of artifice. I mean, if you think about TikTok is the sort of antithesis of Benedict XVI and his very much, like you said, a radical approach because it's ephemeral, it's modern, it's disconnected from anything and everything around it. That's the kind of world against which I think Benedict kind of warns that if you spend all your time in that false world, you're cut off from who you are as an individual, as a species, as a people of God. And that's a real danger. One of the most beautiful things he proposes is the restoration of what he calls a human ecology.
Tell us about that, Joe.
It's the idea that the way we treat the environment.
Well, there's three parts, and the second part has two parts.
Yes, exactly. So in Caritas Veritatis, he talks about – or Caritas in Veritate, he talks about this need to see environmentalism and like the pro-life issue as connected. But the way he describes this is that the way humanity treats the environment and the way we treat other humans are interrelated in both directions. And so if you have a culture of disposability, if you treat a fetus or an embryo as just a product for the parents and you toss them, that's going to be interconnected with an approach that says we're going to just fill the world with disposable plastic and disposable products and everything is single use and then you toss it. It's this world of plastic and latex in a very real sense. That's a world of the culture of death. It's a world of a culture of disposability. And I think that a lot of social conservatives have been good about attacking things like IVF, sometimes things like abortion, but haven't seen this within this broader modern disconnect from nature, all these things are actually interrelated, that caring about the environment isn't just some weird new agey thing. You know, people 100 years ago cared about the environment. People 1,000 years ago cared about the environment. They maybe didn't put it in those terms, but they would see the kind of excesses of modernity as kind of abhorrent and as really a disconnect from the real world, which is a world of nature.
Si, we've been talking in the past 2 hours a lot about Benedict on the liturgy, and I think it would be a mistake simply to dismiss his thought in that regard as, you know, merely wanting to rescue the Mass from, you know, banal songs or whatever it is. In fact, I think it very much derives from what Joe is talking about here, this Christological ecology, if you will, because Benedict says very in his book on liturgy, he says it's in the liturgy that we get our relationship with God properly ordered, and until that relationship is ordered correctly, all these other relationships that Joe is talking about, whether human friendships or our relationship with the natural world, will be disordered unless we get that relationship with God ordered correctly. And it's in the liturgy ordering takes place.
Well, that's beautifully said, yeah.
Exactly. Think about the world of Eden. Man is in right relationship with God, with woman, with himself, and with the natural world. All of those relationships, interpersonal, intrapersonal, the relationship with God and the relationship with the environment or nature, all of those are really harmed in the fall. And we can't just focus on one of those four, but there is nevertheless a priority, and that priority begins with God and flows from there. And so in that sense, like absolutely, Benedict talks about how, in Spirit of the Liturgy, how you have to start with the liturgy, because he says this isn't just a matter of preference, but he looks at the rule of Benedict in which this is talked about. Like if the liturgy isn't first and foremost, if you start with neighbor first, if you start with the environment first, you're going to end up in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. But if you start with God first and you understand from that who you are and who your neighbor is and the world in which you are living, that it's not just a product for consumption, but it's a gift from God, not just for you, but to every generation. Well, that changes how you approach God, but it also changes how you view yourself, your own body, your neighbor, the world around you. All those things are interrelated in a really profound way. Like there's a singularity of vision that really, in Benedict's thought, you can see in just a glance the connection between the liturgy, the pro-life movement, and environmentalism in a way that you just don't see in 99% of other thinkers, including that Catholic thinkers.
But because is it, Joe, could I sum it up in a kind of, I don't think this is simplistic to say it, but he saw it that way because he saw all of those things through the eyes of Christ, that to him the center of it all was the person of Jesus Christ, and the person of Jesus Christ wanted you to know God in nature, wanted you to know God in liturgy, wanted you to welcome the stranger and the infant and the elderly person, that all of it Benedict XVI saw through the eyes of the person of Jesus Christ.
I think that's exactly right. And I think that's the challenge for all of us, and not to be transformed by this age, but to be transformed by the renewal of mind that comes through living in Christ and through Christ. And through that, being transformative in the age in which we're in.
Joe, I'm going to give you the last 15 seconds if you got anything you want to say about Pope Benedict XVI before we close this appreciation.
I would just encourage everybody to pray for him, even though he's extremely holy. I have little doubt of his final destination. It would be a total malpractice as a Catholic apologist not to say we pray for the dead and then we ask them to pray for us in return.
His last words were, "Lord, I love you. Jesus, I love you."
Amen.
Jesus, I love you.
Jesus, yeah. I love you. Let those be my last words.
I know. Let those be all of our last words and the words that guide us every single day. You know, as he said, that the hope that we have for what's to come makes a difference in how we live today. And I hope that people take that message from them, that this hope is not just a hope for the future, but it's a hope that changes this moment and every moment of life up to that very last moment, a moment he has now experienced. May God welcome him into the kingdom, the good and faithful servant that he was. Joe Heschmeyer, thanks.
My pleasure.
Chris Check, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Si.
And praise God. Thank you, Lord, Amen. For the life of Joseph Ratzinger, our former Pope. And we'll see you tomorrow, God willing.